Bible worm, Bible worm, reading the Bible, Bible worm.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Bible Worm. Someday we might be a Bible butterfly, but probably not today. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock, Arkansas. I'm joined this and every week by my friend and colleague Dr. Amy Robertson, biblical scholar and executive director of Congregation Beit HaVerim, a Reconstructionist synagogue in Atlanta. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian. This week we continue our narrative lectionary series with Mark 9, 30-37, in which the disciples argue about who is the greatest, and Jesus welcomes a little child. We talk about the urgency Jesus faces in getting his disciples to understand his mission in the short time he has left with them, the challenge of giving up power to welcome the most vulnerable and marginal in society, and the danger of our well-meaning welcome turning people into props for our own sense of accomplishment. Also, we argue about which of us is, in fact, the greatest. Amy wins. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Amy, how are you this week?
I'm great. How are you?
I am doing really well.
What are we reading?
So today the narrative lectionary has us in Mark chapter 9, verses 30-37. This is like the shortest text that we have done maybe ever on this podcast.
Yeah, very long time.
So starting in Mark chapter 9, verse 30, I'm reading the Common English Bible. From there, Jesus and his followers went through Galilee, but he didn't want anyone to know it. This was because he was teaching his disciples, the human one, or the Son of Man in some translations, will be delivered into human hands. They will kill him. 3 days after he is killed, he will rise up. But they didn't understand this kind of talk, and they were afraid to ask him. So here we have this second prediction of the suffering of the Son of Man. Anything standing out to you in that little section?
What stands out to me in these couple verses is the fact that the disciples are afraid to ask him.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I think this is related to the story that the narrative lectionary skipped. That just happened. We just had a story where Jesus kind of loses his patience.
Yeah.
I couldn't quite tell in that story if it was the disciples or the other people around. But, I mean, he actually says in verse 19, "You faithless generation, how much longer must I be among you?
Yeah.
How much longer must I put up with you?"
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't want to ask follow-up questions to that guy either. Like,
yeah, so you've had that story in which the disciples have tried to cast out a spirit and they can't do it. And so he gets frustrated there. We also had the story we were just talking about back in chapter 8 where Peter finally is able to say, "You're the Messiah." And then the first thing that happens is Jesus says, "I'm going to die." Peter says, "No." And then Jesus calls him Satan.
"Get behind me, Satan."
Yeah.
I mean, no wonder they're afraid to ask.
Yeah. Like, yeah, they're always getting it wrong. And Jesus, I mean, has a little bit of an attitude. He's gotten frustrated along the way with them for not being able to grasp who he is or what he's up to.
It's hard because for whatever reason, I feel for the students in here. I mean, I don't know if it's because I aspire to be a good teacher or a good parent, or because they are the ones that, at least at this point in the story, seem to have less power, or I don't know what it is. But
the
students being the disciples, that don't get it.
Yeah,
and so I tried to sit with the text earlier and say, like, okay, fine, you can feel that for the disciples, but like let's try to have some empathy for Jesus here,
right?
And Jesus is holding a lot,
like. He is.
You know, maybe his own fate, his knowledge of his own fate is weighing on him. Or maybe he's not sure he's accomplished his mission or that he'll be able to accomplish his mission before his time on earth is done. Like, if he leaves the earth before his disciples can do the work they need to do, then this all ends with him, sort of.
Yeah.
Right? And that's a lot of pressure.
I had never thought of that before. I really love that.
I think of it that way. It's sort of as a parent, like in a parenting relationship that I on the one hand, want to be really gentle and gracious to my children. On the other hand, I'm like, you have to figure this out. Like, I can't do this for you. I can't always save you from this. Like, that's not the role of a parent.
That's right. And in the narrative of Mark, we're pivoting right here to Jesus's on his way to Jerusalem, where he knows what's about to befall him. So up until now, we've been in Galilee. Jesus has been living out his earthly ministry. There hasn't been quite the same sense of urgency, but we've pivoted in Mark's gospel. We're on the road to Jerusalem from here on out. And so,
there's like, time pressure.
Yeah, there's time pressure.
Hmm.
I mean, I don't read Jesus, definitely not just as like he was kind of a grumpy fellow, but the kinds of things you're saying make a lot of sense to me. There's some urgency. He needs the disciples to understand. They have not given any sign that they're about to figure it out.
Right. It's very true to life because I feel like this is how these scenarios play out when there's like a stress and an urgent thing that you need to communicate either as a parent or as a teacher or, you know, whatever. And the person's not getting it. But it's also not very effective.
Yeah.
Right. So now the disciples are afraid to ask him. They don't get it.
Yeah.
And they just don't say anything about it. Like, well, that's not, you know, it's not like they don't get it. And so they work hard to figure it out on their own.
Yeah.
They just don't get it.
But I mean, one way of understanding what Mark is up to is that the story of Jesus is really maybe impossible to understand on the narrative side of Jesus's resurrection. So like you can't understand the meaning of the life of Jesus until you have understood the resurrection of Jesus. But the disciples can't do that because it hasn't happened yet narratively.
It hasn't happened, yeah.
So verse 33, they entered Capernaum. When they had come into a house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about during the journey?" They didn't respond, since on the way they had been debating with each other about who was the greatest.
That's so amazing! Oh, I love it! Who was the greatest? I'm the greatest. No, I'm the greatest. Bobby, let's debate who's the greatest.
Sorry. You're the greatest.
You can Oh, stop it! You ruined our debate!
Oh, sorry. I'm the greatest!
Okay, you can continue your lectionary reading.
You know who's the greatest? Bible worm!
Yes.
Yeah.
Bible worm, the wormiest among them.
Floats like a butterfly, stings like a worm. I'm the greatest. It doesn't... Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, this is so human.
It's
right?
So like, human. Jesus is trying to talk to them about this stuff that is so hard to grasp and so huge and so like epically unhuman in some ways, like to wrap your head around this, and they're debating about who's the greatest.
Yeah, I mean, this there's something interesting going on here about how attached humans maybe, or I mean, men, these are all men in this story,
mm-hmm.
Are attached to thinking about power
mm-hmm.
and privilege, prestige. And so this idea of the Messiah, I think they have interpreted it to mean that this person who's going to come as the Messiah is going to reestablish the kingdom, and then that person's going to be the king. And so they want to be close to that power. And Jesus is saying, I'm going to die. He's saying, pick up your cross and follow me.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying that this path that we are on is about humility and lowering oneself to the lowest, you know, to the people who are most marginalized, giving one's life up on behalf of others. Like, there is no power, there is no glory in this life that Jesus is calling his disciples to. And that just like that disconnect about like, they don't know how, like they just literally seem like they can't get their heads to make that shift.
But they also know that they know they've been bad.
Yeah,
like they know they should not tell Jesus that this is what they were talking about.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what that, maybe they have some vague sense of what Jesus is talking about, but they just can't get on board with it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because if they really didn't get it, they would just ask Jesus to tell them who is the greatest.
Yeah.
Like, pick.
Yeah.
They would have gotten a lot of trouble for that.
Yeah, but you're right. Before they were afraid to say anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because they really didn't know. But here it says they didn't respond because they had been debating with each other about who was the greatest. So, like, you're right. They know that they're not supposed to be having this conversation.
It's the next step. It's like unconscious incompetence and then conscious incompetence. They've reached conscience.
Oh, yeah.
Conscious incompetence.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's nice.
Congratulations, disciples.
I mean, knowing what you don't know
Like, is that, yeah. Is that Donald Rumsfeld?
You're, you're like, you're aware of the ways in which you are not good at this.
So originally Peter didn't know what he didn't know. And so it's like, now they know what they don't know.
But they keep doing that.
Yeah. So, I mean, Jesus asks, what were you arguing about during the journey? Mm-hmm. I suppose you could read that as a genuine question. Like, what were you just like, what were you, I heard you squabbling
well,
back there.
He seems to know.
But yeah, that's the way I read it too, is he knows what they were talking about. And he's kind of like trying to call them out there. Mm-hmm. And they know it. Mm-hmm. So now Jesus is going to have a huddle with his disciples. So he sat down in verse 35, called the 12, and said to them, whoever wants to be first must be least of all and servant of all. What's the NRSV's translation there?
It's very similar, but it says must be last of all instead of least.
So first must be last.
Yes. Yeah. Which made me think of the classic rhyme. What doesn't rhyme? First is the worst. Second is the best. Third is the one with the hairy chest. Do you know that?
No.
That's when my sisters and I used to race.
What does that even mean?
We used to race and like we all wanted to be the winner. And so whoever got there first would be like, I'm first. I rule all. And then everyone else would say, first is the worst. Second is the best. And then sometimes a third had a treasure chest. Sometimes a third had a hairy chest.
Oh. So the hairy chest is a good thing.
I don't know. It was unclear. The main point was that just because you're first, the first is the worst. And the second is the best. And then it just goes on from there.
So Jesus has said first is the worst and...
and last is the best.
First is the worst. Last. I really need it to rhyme.
Worst.
Last is the best. So substantively...
yes.
What do you think Jesus is up to? Like, what does that mean? Whoever wants to be first must be least of all and servant of all.
You know, the last time we had a reading where there was this sort of, not like word game, but where it was sort of like, those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it.
Yeah.
I felt like I got that one.
Yeah.
This one, whoever wants to be first, so whoever wants to be, I guess, most powerful first in that way.
Yeah.
Must position oneself with great humility.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I mean, this is what, like, Jesus is presaging his own crucifixion here, right? So, like, Jesus, when he dies, is taking on the least position of all the positions. Like, he dies the worst, kind of the worst death that one can die. Mm-hmm. And so then the disciples, I think, are being called to do that, too. Like, you have to lower yourself and become the one who puts everyone else ahead of yourself.
Mm-hmm. And that... somehow, like obviously not in a direct translation, does that mean you're going to like suddenly have a bunch of riches or whatever, like not that kind of first, but somehow that will translate to winning.
Yeah, no, that's
like,
exactly
in a different, you know, like that how you really win is this way, but winning now means something else.
Yes, in the fullness of the kingdom, you'll be first in the kingdom or something like that. Mm-hmm. Which I don't love that logic. Like, mm-hmm. to me, that still seems like kind of a patriarchal logic about, like, the at the end of the day, the goal is to be the best in the kingdom.
Right.
But in order to get there in the next kingdom, you need to be the least in this one. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's better than, like, strive to be the best here and now and, like, mm-hmm. heck with other people. But the goal of it still is being set up as, if you want to be the best, you got to be the best at being humble. Like,
let's hold that and see how it fits into the next thing.
So verse 36, Jesus reached for a little child, placed him among the 12, and embraced him. Then he said, whoever welcomes one of these children in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me isn't actually welcoming me, but rather the one who sent me. So, like, welcoming a child, how do you process that? Like, what's the significance of a child in particular?
I mean, I feel like this is not a particularly deep thought about this, but I think of the child as sort of symbolic of a vulnerable creature.
Yeah.
And so if you're welcoming the most, to welcome the most vulnerable creature, like that's the path to welcoming God. And you have to give up the idea that in order to be connected to this ultimate power of God, you have to give up the idea of amassing power. Like amassing power, like earthly power, is not going to connect you to the ultimate power.
Yeah.
You have to connect through caring for the vulnerable or being vulnerable or...
Yeah, I think that's great. I really love that. Like, if we're thinking about in family structures in the ancient world, then the child is, like, the lowest on the family ladder, right? Like, it's different than our culture, where oftentimes the child is, like, the most important person in our families, right? Like, the family kind of revolves around the child. But in this case, I think we're thinking about a family structure in which the child is the one with the, like, the least rights and the least, you know, like, the lowest in the family structure. And so then if you think about Jesus's followers or the kingdom of heaven or whatever as a family structure, then it's the child who, like, has the...
Oh, I like that.
The least...
The least status.
The least status. That's the word I'm looking for. Yeah, thank you, thank you. The least status. Which gets you, I think, to the same place that you got us. So on the one side is who's vulnerable in the world, who has the least status in the world, who is the least important in the eyes of the world. That sort of constellation of things, Jesus is saying, when you welcome that person, whom the, this child represents that, and then you can sort of symbolically move out from there. And what Jesus says is, if you welcome those, you welcome me. So it's not exactly like welcome them because, you know, I think that's important, but it's actually when you welcome them, you're welcoming me. Like,
Okay. So I have a question for you related to that statement and then something you were saying a minute ago about sort of power structures and the way that this text is sort of playing with power structures and upsetting them, but still using them. So if you know this and like you really get it, you get that you're supposed to welcome people of lower status, people who are vulnerable, and you welcome the heck out of those people, but you do it only so that you will be connected to the ultimate power. Like you do it as a way to amass power. Does that ruin it?
So if you welcome a child, you welcome me, but you're not actually welcoming me. You're welcoming the one who sent me.
The one who sent me. Which is God. So it really is like your path to the uppity up is to welcome this little snotty-nosed child. Wipe their nose.
I think that there's definitely a system here that one could work, right? So like if what you really, really want is to be connected to God, the way to do that is to... I like the way you said that. Like, welcome the heck out of vulnerable people.
Yeah, that's beautifully. I mean, I could really turn a phrase,
but you can.
I mean, yeah.
You are the best.
I'm the best.
In which case, I'm actually saying you're the least.
Oh, wait, that was an insult.
In this topsy-turvy world in which we live, you're the best is an insult.
Oh, no.
No, I think that, I think you're right about that. But then I also think, like, okay. Like, let's imagine a world when everyone is trying to be powerful by welcoming vulnerable people. Like, you can think of worse places to live.
You know what? I think you are 100% right. There are many secular folks in my life and among my loved ones who sometimes see religion as like a stick, right?
Yeah.
Like, to try to force people to behave ethically by attaching some kind of like reward and punishment scheme to behaviors.
Yeah.
And those folks... imagine, like, wouldn't it be so much better if people could just recognize the goodness of the inherent goodness of welcoming a person of low status without having to have this, you know, if you welcome that person, then you, you know, sort of have an in with the ultimate powers of God. But I came to exactly the same place that you did. Like, okay, maybe that would be great. But humans are humans and, you know, are often aligned to sort of power structures. And wouldn't it be so great if our power structure were oriented towards caring for the vulnerable?
Yeah.
Instead of kowtowing to whoever the powerful person is at the time in order to stay in their good graces.
Yeah, I like that. This has created a structure that incentivizes welcoming the vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that may not be a perfect system, but it's better than...
It's not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad. I think that the other piece that is there is, you know, Jesus is God's representative on earth. And what Jesus has done is, or what he's about to do anyway, is lower himself to serve the people, the lowest of the people. Like, he's putting himself there with them. So where I was thinking about that is, if you then attach yourself to God by serving the most vulnerable, what you end up figuring out is that the God to whom you have attached yourself is exactly the God who takes on human form and goes amongst the vulnerable. So, like, mm-hmm. God is not a God who exercises that kind of power, at least if you take Jesus as the representative mm-hmm. of God. So that whole thing has played, like, you know, you think you're going to get attached to this ginormous power, but in fact, you end up attached to this, like, selfless giving power of love in the world or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, at the end of the day, the kingdom of heaven, I mean, I don't know, I might be talking a little speculatively, but the kingdom of heaven ends up not being a power structure. It ends up being a community that's grounded in self-giving love of God. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. And I mean, in some ways, it's really smart to be like, well, we're working, I'm taking God's perspective here. Like, we're working with humans, right? Yeah. The humans, they like their power structures.
Yeah.
So we're not going to be able to just say, never mind that.
Yeah.
But if we can teach them that, okay, if what you really want is to be close to God, if you really want to be first in that way, then you're going to have to go around this, you know, go around back, basically. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it reminds me a little bit of, my mind is such a strange place. In romantic relationships, a lot of times we get the idea that, like, if a partner really loves us, they'll guess what we need and want, and we won't ever have to tell them.
Yeah.
And if they don't guess, then they don't love us.
Yeah.
And if we need to tell them what we want, then we feel like somehow it reflects poorly on our connection.
Yeah.
But I feel like by being explicit about, like, I feel like this sort of turns it on its head and is like, no, I'm actually going to tell you exactly what's going to have to happen for you to have a good relationship with God. Like,
yeah.
And so sort of going back to all the folks in my life who are secular and might not want to see this, might say, like, no, you should figure it out yourself.
Yeah.
Sure, that sometimes works and that's great, but it also is really good to just say say what it is you need. And I feel like that's what yeah. Jesus is doing here. Like, if what you want is some kind of connection to God and to that sort of, like, ultimate power, this is what you're gonna have to do.
Yeah. No, I love that. And keeping in mind that this saying comes in the context of Jesus is correcting his disciples who have just been arguing about who's the greatest. Like, this is
right,
where they are.
That's what they're going to do. Even though they know it's wrong,
yeah.
they're going to do it. This is like built into them, at least at this juncture in their lives.
Yeah.
So he's got to work with what's there. So that's much better. That's a much better, like, pedagogical.
Yeah.
I was a little hard on Jesus earlier for his pedagogy.
When he's meeting them at an argument about who's the greatest, he's got to take their terms and show them something different.
Those disciples were lucky they did not live in the age of the YouTube dares.
You're going to have to help me a little.
No, like, it's stupid. People dare each other to do the most ridiculous things and then they tape it on YouTube, but it gets bizarrely competitive.
So, like, they would have been taping their conversation and Jesus would have gone
They would have dared each other to do dumb things to prove their greatness.
Oh, I gotcha.
And then whoever did the dumbest of the things and didn't die would be the winner and the greatest. And that would have made Jesus super mad.
Super mad. Yeah. So mad. Okay, so I'm going to complicate this thing a little bit by asking you the following question.
Mm-hmm.
This message of, if you want to be the greatest, you need to become the least. So this assumes, as we've been doing a little bit, that people kind of have a natural tendency to want power. Mm-hmm. But there are lots of people, mm-hmm. Many of whom are women, who are placed in society in such a way that, like, the whole way that society orients to them is that they ought to lower themselves and serve other people.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is not that they want to be the greatest. The problem is that they're always giving themselves up mm-hmm. for other people and not taking care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know quite how to make Jesus is dealing with his male disciples who are arguing about power.
Yeah.
So you might imagine if he was having this conversation with his female followers, he might say something different. But what does somebody do? What do you think one ought to do with a text like this if your problem is not that you want power, but that you're too much giving of yourself?
I am so glad that you asked that question. And I think you're exactly right. Like, I think he is telling this particular group of disciples what they need to hear in order to progress spiritually.
Right.
Right? I don't know what he would tell a group of women or a group of people who have been oppressed in different ways. And I don't know if the gospel ever gives us that. I think that's one of the hard things for me in the biblical text generally about having it so male.
Yeah.
I just read recently a really interesting feminist critique of AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, that was it's in the New York Times. You can look it up if you want to. But it was not saying there's any – it was not – I mean, the AA works great for lots of people. That's great. That's wonderful. But was sort of pointing out that it really was – the program was built upon – it was built for a particular crowd who had a certain status in society and struggled with power in a way that was very different than women might struggle with it. And so all of the – you know, some of the ways the program is built, sort of asking you to recognize your powerlessness, might be really important if that's where you are relative to society, and might be really harmful if that's not where you are.
Yeah.
So that's not a great answer, but I think seeing the specificity of this here and the context in which Jesus gives this instruction and to whom he gives the instruction is really important.
Yeah.
Maybe this is not a general instruction for everybody in all times, in all situations, but for these particular disciples who were doing like foot races or whatever they're doing.
No, yeah, I think that's right. I think that's really well said. And the vulnerable person, the person without status, is represented in this text.
Mm-hmm.
And what is said to them is welcome, right? Like the child in this text, I think, is representing people who are not in positions of power, and they are brought to the center.
Mm-hmm.
And like all that's said to them is, like, welcome.
Right. They're symbolic. I mean, and that's good. It's good to say welcome, but it's still, it feels like that character is sort of being acted upon or used as a symbol. Like, it doesn't, it doesn't speak to that person. It speaks about that person.
That person doesn't have agency. Is that what you mean? Like,
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're like a prop in the story.
Yeah. Because what I was thinking was, like, the instruction is given to the disciples who are the ones who are not vulnerable in the story. And so the non-vulnerable people are told lower yourself. But the child who is the vulnerable person is not told that.
Isn't told anything.
It's just welcomed in. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading that as a good thing. Like, you know, like being embraced by the community is a good thing. But what you're saying is really important, that there's a way of making that welcome that robs people of their subjectivity, robs people of their...
I mean, yeah, I think it is a good thing to welcome someone in. It just doesn't say anything about what happens next.
Yeah.
Oh, that got complicated there, Bobby.
It did. It did, which is good. Like that.
Good. We like a complicated text.
So when you start to think then about what this text has to offer to you or community, what kind of messages are you seeing here that might resonate today?
So what I was going to say before this great conversation that took me to a new place, which all the greatest conversations do that, right? It's the greatest. This is the greatest conversation.
I don't know whether to be insulted or not.
No. You'll never know. You're going to be confused forever. This text made me really sort of step back and think about Jesus as a teacher and think about, and sort of as a parent, like a parent / teacher, you know? And it had me sort of wondering about stressful parenting situations when that a parent is holding a lot and they also feel the pressure to prepare their child. Like I was envisioning the situation where a parent is ill or like Jesus does, knows that their time is short and is trying to prepare their child to be functional in the world, and how different that is from the romanticized ideas of parenting that we might see on sitcoms or get from Hallmark cards or get from, you know, which is not to say that we want our children to be afraid to ask us questions, but the role of really teaching someone to be independent from you and functional without you.
Yeah.
It has a lot of these pain points in it. And I feel like we get to see some of these in this story, and for parents in particular who maybe are hurting right now because they're in this kind of situation, I just think it's really affirming and comforting to see that, like, this is real. Like, it's real even when you're half divine. Fully divine.
Without confusion, division, or separation.
Okay, got it. Even then, it's hard. It's hard to walk. And just in the course of this story, to see it move from, like, my critique that, like, the disciples shouldn't be afraid to ask Jesus a question,
yeah,
to the sort of really tailored teaching that he offers for that group is, I don't know, I just think it's really real. I think it's really present in the world, and I bet there are people in all of our communities who are trying to figure out how to walk this path.
Yeah, that's really lovely.
What do you think? What do you take with you?
Like, the first way I read this text is thinking about churches, which is kind of what I do.
And as especially, you do.
Yeah, and in particular, like, thinking about churches that have some status in the community, mm-hmm, and the ways that those churches exercise that status. And, you know, sometimes I think that, I mean, all communities, not just churches, but all communities can get caught up in this, like, we want to be the best of the whatever we are, right? We want to be the church that grows the most, or the church that, you know, like, has the most, like, the best reputation in town.
Best social justice ever.
Best social justice, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we can get in this kind of one-upsmanship about how, like, who can serve the kingdom the best. But what we're really interested in is kind of our own cultural significance, our own cultural power.
Mm-hmm.
And so this text to me is saying, like, we need to be putting ourselves in a position to welcome the most vulnerable people in society, which often does not look like being the most culturally relevant and powerful community that's around, right? Because, mm-hmm, I mean, the way you dress and the way you speak and the relationship to money and, you know, all of these things, like, send a message about who is and is not welcome. And this text is saying, the central thing is to welcome the most vulnerable, the least status, the least privileged in society. And that's where Jesus is. At the same time, I was thinking about my little worshiping community, Mercy Community Church, whose goal is exactly to welcome people, kind of whoever they are, however vulnerable they are, into the community. And so I was feeling a little self-congratulatory, to be honest with you. Like, hey, like, Jesus would have liked what I'm doing. And then I was like, dang it. That means that I'm thinking of myself as better than the other disciples because I'm better at welcoming them. But the thing that really
has... That is so tricky.
It is really tricky.
It's so tricky.
You can't be welcoming people. I mean, you can, I guess. Like, Jesus meets me where I am, right? Like, if the best I can do is welcome people because it makes me feel proud of myself to welcome people, like, that's better than, like, not welcoming people. But it's not great. But the thing that you really made me think about is the status of the child. Like, I was like, welcome is good. And your kind of observation that, like, well, but the way they welcome this child is they make him a prop, has made me start to think about, like, the ways in which we, I think all of us, well-meaning people, turn vulnerable people into props for our own sense of accomplishment, and the dangers that are there about taking away people's agency by just, like, by welcoming them in, which is a great thing,
mm-hmm,
but not giving them any agency or letting them shape us or letting them be actors in their own story. And I think a lot of church mission and a lot of church service, and I think in some ways, including my own, runs that risk of turning people into props for our own sense of accomplishment.
Oh man, humans are so complicated.
Also, God is complicated. When you put them together, super complicated.
Oh, man, yeah. Super complicated, but super interesting.
Super interesting. So next week on the podcast, we are talking about Mark chapter 10, verses 17 to 31, which is the story of, it's a good one.
What is it?
It's the story of the rich man who is asked to give away all his possessions.
I bet he didn't want to do that.
He did not want to do it. And then the disciples are like, what hope does anybody have? And Jesus says something about a camel that doesn't make any sense to me.
Perfect. I look forward to the rich man and the camel story.
Yeah, it's going to be great. It's going to be great.
Yeah, that sounds fabulous. This has been such an illuminating conversation.
It has been. It's always good to talk to you, Amy.
You too. Have a fabulous week.
See y'all next time.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. Our theme song today was sung by Sam Coker of Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary in Chicago. If you'd like to be featured on Bible Worm, just record yourself or your group or a hapless stranger, we suppose, singing our theme song, and send it to us at BibleWormPodcast@gmail.com. We'll be back next week to discuss Mark 10:17-31. We'll see you then.